You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at mofad.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Michelle Chappelle. We'll talk to Michelle about Beaujolais, Gamay, Domaine Chappelle, and a lot more. We'll taste a Juliana.
What? Juliana.
For our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. American sommelier turned French winemaker Michelle Smith Chappelle worked in New York's finest restaurants, including Per Se and Brooklyn Fare, combining for at some point six Michelin stars. She met David Chappelle in Beaujolais, got him to move back to New York, and both eventually packed up and moved back to France.
Indeed.
To make wine. Michelle Smith Chappelle is the proprietor, with her husband David, of Domaine Chappelle in Beaujolais. Michelle, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming in. We are pre-Beaujolais bash, which is part of La Paulée, and we are in the hotel lobby of the Beekman in downtown New York, so you'll hear a little noise in the background. Michelle, let's give our listeners a little context of who you are. So give us a little background on your journey in life in wine that got you to your current position, which is with David owning a domain in Beaujolais.
Yes, it's been a long journey, taking me many places, but currently living in Beaujolais, but I was born and raised in Connecticut. When I was 18, I moved to New York to go to school at Pace University, which is about a block away from where we're sitting right now. So this was my first neighborhood in New York. Feels like a lot's changed. Started working in restaurants while I was going through school, and I eventually made it to Per Se with the idea that I wanted to work in wine, and I was quite young, and once I got there, I realized I had a whole lot more to learn than I thought.
When you got to Per Se, you didn't get there for wine. You just got...
It was a goal. I wanted to be on the sommelier team.
Okay.
But you first have to get
into the door.
Exactly.
And work here. So that's what happened.
Yes.
Okay.
And so
what year was that about when you got to?
2006.
Okay.
I think it was just shortly after they had opened.
Okay. So you get to Per Se.
And I worked. I stayed there for about 4 years, but working through different positions, and eventually made it to the wine team as assistant sommelier.
Just out of curiosity, how long had Per Se been open?
If I remember correctly, they were open in 2004.
So only a few years.
Yeah,
it was
the way the timing worked out, it was about a year. It was like their sophomore year of opening, but maybe at like the extremes. But yes, somehow it worked out that way.
So you work your way up to assistant sommelier.
Yes. Yeah.
Who was the head somm?
When I started there, it was Andre Mack.
Okay.
Who I learned so much from like grace and style, and he was really an accessible person.
And Andre now has his own wine
Andre's
label, right?
Andre's killing it.
Yeah.
Yes.
He's actually, yes. We're actually going to meet up at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
Ah,
he's going to be a guest.
Hey.
I'll tell him we sat together. All right, so you spend how long at Per Se?
A little under 4 years.
Then what happens after 4 years?
After 4 years, I left. Took about a month or two to take a break. It was a pretty intense and work schedule there, so I took a little time off, and then I applied for a position at Brooklyn Fare. At the time, I was in downtown Brooklyn.
Right.
I was in either late 2009 or 2010, like right around that time.
What What compelled you? What do you know about it? Was there a buzz about it then?
No, it was not known. It was.
It wasn't.
I mean, it was known by a few individuals who really like seek out restaurants and that were
right.
that the buzz was there, but on a micro scale, you know. But there were
right.
certainly people, and within that community,
it was unrated at that point.
It was completely unrated. There was no reviews.
Okay.
There was now no review, and it was quite different than how. It was after that, it was at the same time it was just like a prep kitchen, and it was Cesar Ramirez, the chef, and a small team. There was one other person helping him cook and plate and do the food, and it was a very low-key operation, but that with but ran at an excellent level.
So let's make a quick comparison. So you get to a place like Per Se, which is, you know, a hallowed Michelin-starred restaurant.
And very intimidating when I was young.
Intimidating. The wine program is somewhat established. There's bottles, trophies, and all of that.
Yeah.
You have the luxury, fun, and opportunity to be part of that at every level. Then you come to Brooklyn Fair, and it seems like it's...
Well, there's nothing at the time. It was a BYOB restaurant, which made it
you
pretty
put
special.
That was my question. You put the list together?
I did, yes. It took a little while to get the wine license. It was delayed by about a year and a half. So when they opened, there was nothing. It was all BYOB, and it remained that way for about a year and a half after. And even through that time.
But you were working towards permits and establishing a list. Were you buying wines at that point?
No, you can't buy anything.
Oh, right.
I was putting the list together always in, like, meeting with...
Frustrating.
I was meeting with wine reps, and I was going to visit wineries, and I was tasting, and I was going to portfolio tastings, but it was just with this hope that we
doing
would
all
actually,
the wine stuff.
Yes. Right. Oh, yeah. So it was a scramble at the end, too, when we finally did get the license, which was incredible, the feeling of finally. But then it was the middle of winter, and all of the... Everybody was basically on vacation because it was right around Christmas. So I had already scheduled a trip to California as a tasting trip, but I had to come back early to really get the list together for the reopening.
So
it was a scramble.
And
it was a 3-star restaurant at the time. It had gotten 3-star Michelin in the time.
Before they had wine... A license and a wine program.
Yes,
So it was now a wild ride. You're tasked
restaurant be every
with pairing or establishing a wine list to Caesar's cuisine, which was...
Yes, but over the years, so I mentioned it was BYOB, so at the time we were pretty lucky where people were coming in and bringing their own collection because they wanted it to match the food, so they were bringing really incredible wines, and these were things that I wouldn't have had access to had I had purchased. These are old vintages of wines and really just remarkable. And it was a beautiful time. It was quite unique.
So did you have a little budget? Were you able to start buying?
Once the program was
in?
Yeah. I would say the budget was flexible. The owner, who's still the owner, he gave a lot of freedom and flexibility, both to Cesar, the chef, with the food and the ingredients he was using, and myself also. There weren't too many limitations.
Right.
I limited myself, but we had a lot of freedom.
So you spend time at Brooklyn Fair. They eventually move into the city. I think they are still a 3-star
restaurant.
But it was
restaurant. Still in Brooklyn when I...
I know.
Yeah. It's still 3 stars, yeah.
Yeah, it's still 3 stars.
Different location now.
But. Right. But you... move along and move out of there. Why?
Why did I eventually leave the position?
Leave Brooklyn Fair, yeah.
Ah, okay. Well, I was there for about 5 years working the floor, and then for the last part of it, for the last several months, I was working on opening the new restaurant in Manhattan.
Okay.
And putting the wine list together there. And then my now husband, David Chappelle, he and I decided that we would, at that point in our lives, our careers, that we would move to Beaujolais and start our own project, our own winery, and we would.
All right, so we set up part of your life. Now you mentioned something, which is another important part.
Okay.
While you're working, you meet a guy named David Chappelle.
Yes, I met him in Beaujolais.
Just tell me that story quickly, because that's critical to who and what you are, what you're doing.
Yeah, it was a point that changed the trajectory, I would say, of what was happening. I thought I would live in New York forever. I had moved here in the year 2000.
Right.
I thought I'd always be here. I love New York. But yes, things changed then. And it was 2013, and I was in France on vacation, but tasting.
Pleasure.
Yeah, but always when I had
You're always looking around.
Little bit of vacation time.
Right.
A little bit of vacation time, I would always go tasting, usually in France. So I had about 10 days, and I set up a tasting trip from the Rhône, and then it was going to end in London. So we tasted everywhere in between, like Burgundy, Champagne, Paris. But on the second day of the trip, after I had met in the Northern Rhône with Hervé and Béatrice Suo, I was coming to Beaujolais, and I had one tasting appointment, and it was at Domaine Lapierre.
Which is a legendary Beaujolais maker.
Of course, yeah.
This good stop.
Really, you know, and all credit to Marcel Lapierre, who was really at the forefront of everything and made so much possible. It made what we're doing now today possible.
Right.
So, yes. So I was really looking forward to this tasting, and unfortunately we got there late. And Mathieu, the winemaker, had already left because he had to go pick up his daughter. And so I left him a note and just said that we would be in Villers-Morgon. We have nothing else planned. So if it, you know, with huge apologies, but if it was at all possible, we would love to still do a tasting at any point in the day. We'll meet him, you know. And he did end up contacting us, as there's one bar in Villers-Morgon. So he figured out where we were. And he called and he said, I can't come. You know, I have already left, but I'll send an employee for my domain. So as we're waiting, we had a quick lunch, a couple glasses of Beaujolais, and then David showed up. As he was working at La Pierre at that time. So,
right.
Yeah, he was the employee. So, voila.
So he shows up at your tasting, and...
Well, he came to pick us up, to bring us
to
back.
To pick you up,
to
right.
To bring us back to La Pierre for
but
a tasting.
It's sort of the old, the rest is history line, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you guys just spent the next...
But I go back with it now. I told him, okay, I knew, like, I knew immediately. You know, I had this feeling immediately. As soon as I met him, I was like, oh, wow. It's
you
hard
moved.
To explain, you know, but it's a
right.
It's a feeling. It's almost like when you taste a wine, and it's so compelling, and you just have that, you have that moment, and you're like, wow, this is something impactful, and that's the moment I met him, I felt that way. So.
So,
but he says he didn't feel that way, but that's okay.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Sure. That's why he followed you around for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
so you get him to come back to New York because you're here.
Well, he came with me for the rest of that trip. So that day we met and we spent the day together and important to note. So I had a tasting. I was trying to set up a tasting that day at Domaine Foyard with Jean Foyard, and he would not. Take it. He would denied my visit.
Why? Because he's a La Pierre guy or something?
Maybe because I didn't speak French at the time. I don't know. Jean, you know, he makes his own decisions, and I respect that. But I couldn't get into Foyard, and I really wanted to taste there. And so I told David the story, and he's like, oh, well, we can just stop by. Let's just go. You know, it's like, wow, this guy's so cool.
Right.
This guy is amazing. So we went there. We had some drinks at Foyard. It was a magical day. It was pretty incredible. So after that, he followed me, for the rest of the trip.
Your
he came
trip.
With me. Yeah, we went to London, and then he had to go back to work at La Pierre, and I had to go back to work in New
York. But you got him to come to New York?
Well, he came to visit a month later, and then when he was here, we decided that he would move to the U.S. so we could be together and try to make it work.
And you were here together for a few years, right?
Yes, yeah. Then we stayed for another couple of years here.
Then what's the moment where you decide, let's go back and do something?
I don't even remember, really. I don't know. I think it was something that was building. And
okay.
I don't remember, actually, the
so
moment.
So you decide to go back to France,
yes.
To Beaujolais,
yeah.
With the intention of...
To set up our own domain, yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
We wanted to
so
farm
that,
our land.
So that was what year? We're not...
2015.
Right.
We left in just the day harvest was starting around there, like September 2015.
All right, so... A little further down the show, we're going to talk about the domain and, you know, really what's going on there. I want to ask you a few other things. Why the shift away from fine dining to do this?
I guess we just like challenges, and we wanted to, or certainly I do. I enjoy change in scenery. I like things to be new, challenging.
Did you have enough of the floor and the hours and
oh,
all
for
that?
Sure. That also,
that
yes.
Was another...
Oh, of course, yeah.
I mean, could you imagine being a pregnant mom doing that?
No, I mean, I have so much respect for...
The people who do it.
Yeah, and just the strength it takes. And
right.
The endurance, and there's
so,
a lot you have to...
Time for a new challenge, change of scenery.
Yes, exactly, and
okay.
I always had this idea since I was maybe like a younger sommelier that I wanted to live in France. I in Beaujolais, when I went to visit, that was the first time in 2013 that I had visited Beaujolais. I had been to France many times.
Ever to Beaujolais in 13?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
And you obviously really just loved it.
Taken aback by it.
I loved it, and Beaujolais is one of the most beautiful places in the world, like for everything, for the landscape, for the culture, for
Was there anything you did at Per Se or at a Brooklyn Fair that prepared you or helped you in what you're doing now?
No, I'm learning still as I go. There's nothing
so
to prepare
you. So it was like two
to...
different parallels. You were involved with wine. This is wine.
I'm still learning. I get schooled every day. I get schooled every day in every aspect of life, but especially
so on
in
a general day. Term, what are the most obvious changes you've gone through, and what are the challenges? I guess learning, but, you know.
Yeah, to learn another language, you have to communicate in a language, you're not always able to express yourself the way you want to. That was a challenge. We have twin daughters that are 2.5 years old. That's, two kids at once.
Starting a business?
Exactly. We did all of that at the same time, too. It's like buying the house, winery, starting the winery, kids, the wedding. We definitely packed it in.
David's been around it, but, you know, it's sort of like a mom. You know sort of how to be a mom, but you really don't.
Yeah, you learn
on the
job.
You sort of know how to open, right.
Even now I'm a mom, but I'm learning every day. You know, you learn every day.
Yeah. That's interesting. I thought maybe you'd get a little more out of your past to help you with, you know, your current thing. But it really is, you know.
I would say tasting ability.
Yeah.
Tasting ability would be the number one
thing. Which is important,
then.
You know, because ultimately you're putting a product out.
Yeah.
All right, so you obviously have a love for Beaujolais, the region.
Enormous.
And I guess the Gamay grape.
Yeah, I definitely believe in the excellence of Beaujolais and just how it can be expressed in that place, how it's very unique and the
Why
different
not?
Terroirs.
You never were drawn to Pinot Noir, let's say?
Oh, of course, I love Burgundy, and this is the basis of my knowledge as a sommelier,
right.
And Burgundy was and remains one of my first loves in life. Of course, this is...
I brought up Burgundy. We have to dispel a few things. What I want to do is let's talk a little about Beaujolais.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it as the region and every, you know, the grapes, the terroir, the climate, just so people know where you are and, what they're doing there. And then we'll talk, you know, about the domain and all of that. So give me a little primer on the region. Well, so Beaujolais... Is or is not Burgundy?
Beaujolais is not Burgundy.
Okay.
Beaujolais is,
you're emphatic about that.
Beaujolais is Beaujolais, and it exists on its own, completely separate from other places. It has its own magic. And I think as when I was younger, as everybody does when you read books, and still today, you'll find the same sort of narrative where Beaujolais is southern Burgundy, and it's not. It shares the same department. When you are north of Romanèche-Tourcoing, if you're south of Fleury, you're in the Rhone department, Rhone the 69. And if you're north, where Moulin-en-Avant would start in the town of Romanèche-Tourcoing, then you are then in Zone Noire. And this shares the same department with Burgundy, but aside from that, there's, I think more of the connection that people talk about is because it's written over and over. But if you are there,
so you're one of those guys.
The grapes are different.
Right, Beaujolais and Burgundy.
No, it's completely separate. It's
all right.
It's
so
its own magic.
That's the location. I mean, it actually is closer to the Rhone than
it
you
is,
know, the
and
hearts
the, of and the culture is closer to the Rhone also. But
right.
it's close to Lyon, being about 35. Where we are in Trenet-Durette is about 35 minutes north of Lyon.
So let's talk feel and climate. Temperature, I mean, it's a temperate region.
A lot warmer right now than New York.
Yeah, well, you got stuck with the snow, but you're not.
This year's very
mild.
It's not
totally foreign to you.
Last year was brutal. This year is mild. But there you get a lot of fog. It's rainy. It snows a little bit, but more up in the mountains.
Do you get a little Mediterranean influence or not?
You can certainly feel when the wind comes from the south. You get the Mistral, and it comes in. It's very heavy, and it brings warm wind. Yeah. Like last week, we were working in Chorub in the vines, and I was in a T-shirt because the wind was coming from the south.
Do you listen? You've done a handful of vintages, but do you think or sense from talking to people that any kind of climate change or global warming mm-hmm. has an effect on harvests and timing?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you see now, and you'll definitely warmer vintages. You saw with 2015, which was a very hot vintage, and even the best winemakers who had seen many vintages before that had a hard time like controlling what that became, and it was very high alcohol. It brought a little instability to the wines, and Brett was a large issue that year, where it's coming in possibly on the grapes, but with like the higher pHs, it definitely took effect of the wine.
Then when you go to the next year, give me the
difference. And 16 was rich also, and 17 again, so, but certainly not at the same level of 15. 15 was...
But 15, a decent vintage though, right? For the end product?
I prefer to have lower alcohol in.
Yeah.
Or at least the... Yeah, I'm pretty sure everybody in Beaujolais is pretty happy to see the 15s right. out. Where in Beaujolais you tend to open many bottles when people are around, so if it's
right.
very high alcohol,
really
the party might not go
sense
for as long.
Of what every effect had on the wines.
Mm, yeah.
What about terroir? I mean, there's a lot of granite, schist, sandstone.
Certainly, yeah. Granite definitely rules. It's the bedrock. It's the
rules
mother rock.
Beaujolais.
Yes, okay. And then within the different crews you'll see, and also within some parts of the Beaujolais village and Beaujolais. The wines that are classified as those, so, which are usually more on the flatlands, but certainly in the crews, which are all up in the mountains,
right.
You'll find granite. It's pink granite is everywhere, but definitely,
pink granite.
Cool. But from that, there is a lot of soil diversity, and there's recently been a lot of studies and a lot of digging around to find out exactly what those terroirs are, because it has not been as defined as Burgundy. While Beaujolais has less resources. Than financial resources and then Burgundy does, so it doesn't have the same extensive
right.
research yet, but it's happening.
And within Beaujolais and within all that pink granite and other stuff, there are different regions. I mean, there are cru regions, right? I think there's 10 cru regions?
Right now, yeah. And in Beaujolais, there are 10 crus, which are villages that are given an elevated level, have been throughout time proven to produce wines of better elegance, finesse, deliciousness. So,
I mean, we don't have to name them all, but, you
no,
know,
no, no.
Morgon,
yeah.
which Folliard is
Yeah, Fleury and Morgon
Fleury
would
and Morgon
be the most well-known on the Rhone department. Yeah, my husband and I live in Rennes-Durette. And then there's one more.
R-E-G-N-I-E?
Yeah, and a bunch of accents in there.
Right.
R-E-G-N-I-E and then slash Durette.
Yeah. Question. Of the 10 crews, a majority of the wines are made in a handful of the crews. True?
Sorry? What are you...
There are 10 different crews.
Yeah.
Morgon, Fleury. Mm-hmm. Aren't a lot of the wines that are produced in the region made in a handful of those crews? Like a lot of wine comes out of Morgon and
sure, yeah.
There
and,
are
and
regions where there's not a crews
exactly,
where there's not.
Yeah, there's a lot of Beaujolais is still pretty small. You can drive through all of Beaujolais
right.
where the crews are up from like Saint-Amour, and you can drive all the way down to Montpruy, and it would take like half an hour. So it's a small region, but it's definitely densely planted. And you talk about the Beaujolais vine, which is a high density planting.
Explain
so there's
what that
a lot
is.
Of the land is covered.
It's spelled yep. goblet. Gobelet, and that's the way the vines are planted, right?
It's the way that they're trained, which is a freestanding vine. Where it's not on a trellis, so it's a freestanding. Sometimes it's called bush vines. You'll see often in the United States.
And that's you'll see that all through Beaujolais.
Yes, there's a little that are trained on vines, but basically when you're driving through, the majority is in Beaujolais.
Now, before we talk about Chapelle, just talk to me a little about the Gamay grape. It's a thin-skinned grape.
It can be.
Is it a hard?
It depends
grape
on where it's planted, also.
I mean,
Gamay in Beaujolais is really idyllic, and depending on where it is and where the vines are situated, but you'll get a grape that shows flavors, also depending on the vinification.
Right.
You know, because there's a large variance. It's kind of hard to say exactly
right.
what it is, but you get a lot of fruit flavors from it.
It's a low tannin grape, would you say? Lower?
Depending on the vinification, but yeah, if you are doing it in, say, semi-carbonic vinification, like we do at Aardman, and then you will have a grape in a wine with the texture of white wine and almost.
Good acidity, too,
and
right?
Yes, high acidity to right. balance it. So it's a bright, fresh wine. That's.
I guess now's a good time. Tell me what carbonic maceration is, because it's very prominent in Beaujolais.
Yes.
It's part of the winemaking technique.
I mean, it's important to differentiate also because there's carbonic maceration and then there's semi-carbonic, which the majority of wines that you would drink, I would say, are done in a semi-carbonic way.
Which is?
Where fermentation is done in the berry.
The berries are not picked from...
No, we
it's
we
a
harvest...
a whole cluster?
We harvest everything whole cluster.
Whole
everything's
cluster.
Done by hand. In Beaujolais, you have to harvest by hand.
Okay.
And this is usually on slope, so it's serious work with the harvest. So the grapes are cut. They're put into small bins. I'll just talk about in our case, because every domain has a different way. But in our case, the grapes are cut by hand. They're put into very small bins to keep them intact. And then we dump them directly into the fermentation vat. And that way, we fill the fermentation vat, and once it's filled, we put a bit of CO2 in the vat.
It's covered. It's sealed.
Yes,
so
and then we seal the vat. So the fermentation is already going to happen. It just is like a stimulus for it also. So we cover it, and then we let the fermentation start. And a little of that will be pressed juice. It's not pressed. It's like pressed by its own weight.
The bottom stuff from gravity
and
pressure that will break open.
Yeah, in French it's called the tire, but it's free-run juice, really. It's from the pressure of the grapes on top of it.
So the fermentation, because of the carbon dioxide, and correct me or leave me,
mm-hmm.
happens... Because it's a whole cluster
so
closed,
in
and
the
CO2.
It's not crushed. We don't crush
not
the grapes.
Not crushed. The CO2.
No, because it's not crushed. That's why the fermentation
happens
in the berry.
In the actual berry inside the skin,
yeah.
And then it actually.
And you can see it. You know,
down.
After a couple, we leave it in for a couple of weeks, but you can tell too after a while if you go to before you do the découvage, where you take the grapes out of the vat, you devat it. You can pick up a berry and when you pop it, you can see that the ferment has happened. You know, the color changes. It's lighter. It looks more like jelly-like. You can tell by the smell, the taste. But you still retain those fruit flavors.
I should know this, and I don't, but you need to tell me this. So the whole cluster is in the vat, sealed, and you pump in?
We don't do any pumps. We don't do any pump overs.
Not pump, but you add the carbon. The
yes, well, it happens naturally in the grape, but we also add CO2
right
through as like a tank, and then you just climb to the top of that and put a wand in and it and a small amount of
does
CO2.
Does the grape break down, or you have to pull
some
it
of
out?
It does.
You still have to.
Some of the grape breaks down by itself, but even when now that you do the découvage, the devatting, it's you'll still see whole berries intact, and that's 3 weeks later.
And
so,
those just
go. But usually
go,
at the bottom, that would
you
be
don't
crushed.
Crush them, or what, those just.
After that, we'll take everything out. You know, you got to get into the vat and
right.
scoop everything out by hand.
Right.
And at the time, there will be a bit of the free run juice also, which is put to the side. And then we take the grapes that are still there and we put it into a press. We use an old
press.
Traditional Vasselin
okay.
Press. And we press that, and then everything goes back into the vat. We'll mix together both the free run juice and the rest, and then the fermentation continues, making it semi-carbonic.
Right.
Part of it was in the berry, and then it continued as juice.
If someone says to you, what effect does doing semi or carbonic maceration,
mm-hmm.
what effect does it have on the wine?
I think for us, we love the texture that it gives and the fruit flavors that it gives also. And
so it definitely has a major effect on what you're feeling.
Yeah, definitely
and
the texture.
And how you could bring the fruit out and all of that.
Definitely. The texture of the body. But the thing about semi-carbonic is that you can still retain the sense of terroir. So you should be able to taste it and identify where that has come from.
And... most of Beaujolais does some sort of carbonic maceration, right?
Some people do full carbonic, but but to some degree. There's other places will crush. You'll find a lot in a lot of wineries that are north of Fleury, so say in Moulin-au-Vent and Saint-Amour.
Right.
And Juliana, well, they will do more of a Burgundian vinification.
Right.
And where the grapes will be crushed and then vinified as...
Right, so let's...
Not in Berry.
Let's take what we've learned about Beaujolais, the region, and the Gamay grape, and let's talk specifically about what you and David are doing in your domain, Domaine Chapelle. So you are located, you mentioned before, but tell us again where you're located.
In Reigny-Durettes, which is one of the crews. It's it is a higher elevation town that is just on the side of Villemorgon.
Now,
Morgon.
Isn't there a benefit to a higher elevation? I mean, I know styles can vary, but I think it's sought after.
Yes, yeah. But we don't have vines in Reigny. It's where our winery is and our home. Our winery is at our home. So it's all part of the same house.
Right.
But
do you have property there eventually to plant? Or?
I hope so. I mean, I hope that we can take over the vines eventually, maybe around the house. Well, I'd like them to be farmed organically. Since our kids play there, and you know, it's our water supply, so I would
La Pierre was a pioneer in sustainable
and
natural foyard, who you mentioned.
And,
these are important guys. I'm sure David very much, you know, is a believer and practitioner.
No, of course, yeah, and he worked with La Pierre for a while, but he grew up with them. He grew up, sure, not far
from
Beaujolais.
He was like their other son.
Yeah, you know, family, close family friends, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. So where do
he
you...
He grew up with, his father was close with, like, Jules Chauvet, you know, father.
So where are you getting your grapes from? You know, the first few vintages you did.
Well, we started in 2016,
right.
And we didn't have our own land.
Right.
But while David was working at La Pierre, who is Camille La Pierre and Mathieu, brother and sister team who makes the wines there, and they helped us out. So they said that we can use their facility to do the vinification and also the élevage, the aging there. So we did, and that's how we started. We made the Juliana Côte de Bessée from the parcel Côte de Bessée on the northern part of Saint-Amour.
Is that a La Pierre property?
No.
You got it from someone else?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So we started out in that way in 2017 also, and we added a Beaujolais village to what we're doing from the village of Lantigny. And you were asking about the crews earlier. So now there are 10 crews, and this village of Lantigny, which is on the side of Reigny-Durettes, also very high elevation, beautiful terroir, decomposed pink granite, and maybe is up to become the possible 11th crew of Beaujolais. So that's a movement that's happening there. There's something to look out for. But we added a Beaujolais village. And then the following year, in 2018, last January,
That was an exciting year for you guys.
Yeah, we got our own vines, finally, which is what was always the goal. We have two parcels in Cherub, the crew of
Cherub. Spell Cherub for everybody so they know.
I hope I don't mess up. Cherubles. Yeah.
Cherub.
Yeah, so which is quite hard to say, but
so
it's a beautiful
property
place.
There.
Yeah, we have two parcels there, which make up almost 2 hectares, a little under 2 hectares. And then we have another plot in Fleury called Charbonnière, which is also high elevation, what we focus on. And we've got a 1.2 hectare there in this setting that's almost a natural amphitheater that is completely surrounded by the forest. It's very beautiful. You look straight out, and on a clear day, you can see, like, the Mont Blanc in Switzerland. And
beautiful.
It's incredible, yeah.
So when will those wines... Have you picked them yet?
Yeah. So we took them over last year and we started farming them.
So harvest season of 18, you brought them in?
Yes, and we vinified, yeah.
Okay,
so we did all the farming for the year. We started with pruning in January and then went through all the everything.
Typically, when will those wines be released?
We're going to release the Beaujolais Village soon.
Okay.
In a couple months, and then after the cruise will come after. So it depends on the temperature of our surroundings when we bottle, but it's we
so
hope
will
around
the cruise be around sometime in 2019 or into 2020?
No. We're going to bottle earlier, so on the earlier side for everything. So I think around June it will be in bottle. So it'll be.
So you talked about this a little, but the winemaking philosophy and how you make wines,
How do we
carbon, semi-carbonic maceration,
yeah.
low intervention?
Yeah, and ideally no intervention if possible. So far we've been pretty lucky.
Is there anything you do to make the wine?
We do a little. It's a pretty simple operation. You know, we don't have like any crazy equipment, and it's just David and I who work in the winery, so everything is done. It's a low-key operation.
It's about the terroir. It's about the weather that season.
Absolutely. It should be a reflection of that, yes.
You know, how you vinify and all of that. But it's
we're looking for purity of expression of the place.
Right.
Yeah, and deliciousness. I mean, we want a wine that people want to drink in open bottles. And in Beaujolais, this is the best compliment you can get. It's a region that's very, that loves to get together, likes to find a reason for a party, who likes to... find reasons to eat and drink and socialize, and you want to make sure you make a wine where the people you respect are going to drink your wine and want to open up another bottle.
Listen,
this is the goal. You know?
You've gotten good notices. I mean, there's a nice buzz on the wine, so I would say, not entirely as an outsider looking in, you know, that you hit the ground running, which is a nice thing. There's certainly congratulations to that. One last thing. The grapes that you purchase and the grapes that you're going to grow are going to be also low intervention too, right? No pesticides, natural. I mean, that was the La Pierre way. You continue on that?
Yeah. I mean, it's always the goal. For sure, everything that we work also, my husband and I, we work our vines organically. The vines we took over were worked in organic, and the one parcel that was not was... we're converting. We don't use any chemicals. We don't buy them. We don't have them. And we work everything by hand, where you have high density plants. We do everything with a handheld plow. We work in a Troy.
Really?
Yeah. So it's sort of the style of the Northern Rhone, where you'll see the handheld plows on steep slopes. And that's what we believe in. It gives you a reason to be proud of your work. And I wouldn't want to do it any other way. And
you've added hectares. I mean, are you going to have to hire some people, or is it?
Not right now.
Can you two guys?
Between the two of us, we're good right now. We're a bit at the capacity of what we can do at the moment, just as we're growing. But in the future, yeah, it's a goal. I don't think we'll ever be that big. As we like to
That's
control.
That's not an aspiration.
No.
You want to have full
control
and put out the type of product that...
Yeah.
What about the business part of it? I mean, you got to get it in the bottle. You got to get it labeled.
Yeah.
You got to get it distributed. I mean, are you the one that spends a little more time
We do it together. Yeah. Right. Everything we do together. So... But I'm more into that side of it, I would say. So my husband, David, he has less interest. So I tend to take over those responsibilities more, where I have less interest in doing like the racking. So he'll do that
whether he likes it or not, he's doing it.
We share.
You have a good distributor, Grand Cru Selections, who's very much into, the wines and the winemakers and all of that.
Yeah, they're excellent.
I think the frustrating thing probably for them and the consumer is your output is very limited. You're really a smaller operation. But the wines are available on restaurant lists, stores.
While we don't have a lot of volume, it's not the goal. More for us, it's placement. We want to be on the list of, my friends and people, other colleagues, people I really respect the work they do. And for that, like New York and other places in the United States, L.A. and, so many other places, but are just really, really like top-tier wine programs that are exciting. Like, I just want to drink there. Wines I can't even get in the Beaujolais anymore. So
I guess
unfortunate with that.
There's not a lot of negatives. But one of the negatives is that there's not enough to go around, and a lot of people want it, and you want them to have it. But Burgundy's been that way for a long time, and there are other wines.
We want everybody who wants it. We want everybody to have it. It's the goal.
Right.
We don't want to be limited or exclusive, but we do make small quantities.
We're talking to Michelle Smith-Chappelle. Michelle and her husband David are the proprietors of Domaine Chappelle. We talked a little, obviously, about Beaujolais and, what they're doing. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to subject Michelle to our wine list, and we're going to taste the Juliana. And we'll evaluate it, and we'll talk a little more about the grape and the domain and all that. You're listening to The Grape Nation. This is Sam Ben Ruby. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
We're back with my guest, Michelle Smith-Chappelle. Michelle, you cannot escape today without doing our wine list. We ask all our guests to answer 5 questions, and you're pretty worldly in the world of wine, so I think you should do well. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? Not the second, but like, yeah, what are you curious about? What's on your table?
What's fun,
seasonal?
We visit a lot of places that are closer to us now that we're, I would say when I used to visit France and I was a sommelier, I would visit way more places and was much more mobile. But now we have like twins that are young and while we're farm. So we tend to visit places that are local around us. So Jura.
Brigandy,
although it's been a while since I've been to Brigandy. Yeah, I love Jura. This is also a...
Any favorites? I mean, can you give me something specific?
I love Domaine de la Tournelle.
Spell.
Domaine de la, and then Tournelle is Tournelle. They're Jenny and Francois in New York.
Right.
Sells them. Yeah.
Right.
But this is really magnificent work from a husband and wife team.
So you love the Jura.
Yeah. Yes.
Around the
Emmanuel and Anurian, who make the wines under Pierre Auvernois, their work also is
terrific wines.
Yeah, and can't be denied. With
what else are you drinking?
Special. A lot of Gamay.
You're drinking a lot of Gamay.
Yes.
You try and drink everyone's Gamay.
It's very important, yeah, to visit with friends and see what they're up to also, and how things are going.
You know, we didn't talk about this, and I don't mean to interrupt our wine list, but talk to me quickly about the ageability of Beaujolais and Gamay. It drinks well early, but...
Yeah, because it has that high factor of deliciousness. It's good when it's young, and it's like, it goes back to that texture of white wine and those like bright fruit notes.
But can you lay it down for years?
Absolutely, yeah.
And what happens as it ages? Do you lose the fruit? Does it round out?
Of course it's going to pick up more of the secondary notes to it, where you'll find more...
But it handles aging well.
Some of the best Beaujolais are... Can age for a long time.
Okay.
That's why Beaujolais is so special. You can drink it young and enjoy it, and you should, because it has the same... But you can age it. Surely it's a complex wine, and it shows
it's got
the
good complexity. Mm-hmm. All right, second question. Do you, Michelle Smith-Chappelle, have a favorite wine and food pairing?
What have we
been doing?
It
doesn't have to be something you eat every day.
No, I'm a little boring. I eat a lot of vegetables, so...
Okay.
I've been a vegetarian since I was a kid, so... but I would say if I had a dream pairing that I cannot get in the Beaujolais, then maybe sea urchin and champagne, Hokkaido sea urchin with
George
Laval. Or, yeah.
I forgot to tell you, we have a Grape Nation rule. You can't say champagne and oysters, because that's too obvious.
No, it's sea urchin.
But nobody's ever said sea urchin.
Oh, okay.
People have said popcorn, fried chicken, pizza.
Yeah.
So what is it? The saltiness of the sea urchin? A little of the fish with the acidity and bubbly of the champagne.
Yeah, it's just a...
And what'd you say, George Laval?
Flavor. Yeah, maybe a George Laval. Yeah.
Give me another maker you like.
But there are so many. I love champagne. is, I think we drink a lot of Jean Prévost right now. We do an exchange with him. So.
Okay, those are good.
But it's very difficult to find champagne in
is
Beaujolais.
It?
Yes,
really?
So we have to do exchanges with people. It's the only way it exists. Yes.
That's so funny.
I know, it's another world. It's a bubble.
All right. We talked about this before, and I don't want to stump you, but think about it. Do you have a favorite wine restaurant and or bar? And what came up before is there's not a lot of bars of Beaujolais.
In Beaujolais.
But I mean, in
true,
your
yeah.
travels, whether it's been in New York or while you're in town now, I mean, who does it well?
Recently, I had one of the most amazing meals in the 11th in Paris at Le Rigamarole, which is a husband and wife team also from New York.
What's it called? La Rigamarole?
Rigamarole, yeah.
Rigamarole.
Rigamarole. It's
nobody's ever
in the 11th.
That.
It's kind of new, but it's
cool.
Really incredible. They do a lot of yakitori.
That's why we do this, you know,
yeah.
For the great recommendation.
Actually, one of the owners, Jess, she used to be the pastry chef also at Brooklyn Fair, so we had known each other before,
cool.
but her restaurant is just absolutely insane. It's one of the best in the wine program there. It's done by a woman, Chris Lynn, and she has put together such an eclectic list that is so well thought out and her service is so graceful. She's really at the top of what's happening in Paris right now.
What about your time when you were in New York? Anything left over in your mind? Good place or?
Oh, good places?
Yeah.
Oh, this New York is the epicenter of.
But what's a good wine restaurant and
here,
or bar?
Here, Racine, of course.
Which is right down the block from here.
Is
give me one more.
I don't know. I feel like I'm on the spot now. I'm blanking out, but.
Those are good.
No, but there's,
Racine is good, Pascaline, and Rigamarole.
Danielle, I don't know why I'm blanking out right
Danielle's
now.
Danielle's fine. Don't struggle. I don't want you to do that. Do you have a favorite all-time wine or two? Or is there something that you filed in your mind? And, you know, at the beginning, it was always like rare wines and expensive wines.
Yeah.
It turns out the answer becomes more experiential. Like, we had this terrific champagne when we got engaged, blah, blah, blah. Can you think of something that, you know, still resonates?
Maybe a bottle of 96 Chardonnay made by Emmanuel Ouillon at his home, I would say, was with him and
96 Chardonnay.
Yeah.
Emmanuel
96.
Who?
Ouillon. From Auvernois.
What is that?
Houillon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Auvernois.
And his wife.
Okay.
They share the responsibilities.
That's a great answer.
That was really mind-blowing to me, and it was done on a blind tasting. It was his first vintage also, and it just blew my mind because it was...
Good one.
And that was more recently, too. That was maybe in 2013.
Can you tell me the best wine to buy for around $15-$20 retail?
Oh.
Can you give me a red and
a
white? Yeah, I think New York would be better. But you get like Muscadet, we know is a good
wine.
Yeah,
because these wines are
unvalued.
So
you
can
either give me
brilliant.
A category, a grape, you can give me a maker. Like, what's a great, you know, good value wine? By the way, Beaujolais, you know, Village is...
Yeah, you can find really good like Beaujolais Village also for
you know
for
20s
less expensive prices.
Yeah, so we could put that as the red.
Yeah, do you mean retail though? Because I know like from
retail.
Purchasing wine, so it's a different like
retail.
As a buyer.
Well, I'll help you with that.
A different angle.
What kind of white?
But I think you can still find really good whites from maybe the Jura that are under $20. But a
I
Sauvignon.
I think you're right about the Jura Sauvignon. Sauvignon. Sauvignon,
yes,
not Sauvignon. Okay.
Yeah. Sauvignon.
So let's go with a Jura Sauvignon and let's go with a Beaujolais Village.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, those are good ones.
It's for me thinking back too. I haven't been to New York in 3 years, so I'm thinking like, are these still
I know.
Values?
It,
I don't know.
It's tough.
Maybe and now they're like
$100. I ask that question
bottle.
To everyone, and some people are more exposed to retail. Some people are less exposed to it.
Yeah.
But there's still wines that are, you know, in your mind, you know, that are great values, and that's all I'm looking for. All right, so every week on the show, we taste a different wine at the end of the show, and we call it the weekly wine sip. And I thought it would be perfect having you on the show to bring in one of your wines. And you brought in a 2017 Tell me.
So we did this one. It looks the same as our regular bottle. It's a 2017 Juliana from the parcel Côte de Bessée. It was our second year of production. But while we, there was one.
So Côte de Bessée is the parcel.
Yeah.
The parcel where
yeah.
the grape was
This
from.
Is a southeast facing parcel just on the border of Saint-Amour. So it's also high, very steep, high altitude vines. But this particular bottle was pulled. This was a vat that we had that was from the old vine section of that parcel. So this is 65-year-old vines.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, and we bottled it separately and didn't do any sulfurette. While all of our wines in 17 are unfined, unfiltered, and we bottled with a little bit of sulfur in that year, I think it gave the best expression in that way. But this wine is our Cuvée Red Wax. So it's the old vines with no sulfur at all. Well,
You add no sulfur.
Nope.
Sulfur occurs a little naturally.
Of course, naturally in fermentation,
yeah.
But no added. So we didn't, there was none in vinification. And then also at bottling, we didn't because we just bottled it because we wanted to drink it. It was tasting very good. While it was from the old vines. It was tasting a bit different, like taste flavors of like dusty earth and rose. And
well, let's get into that.
Okay.
Because we're going to go color, nose, mouthfeel, palate. You know, okay. We're going to lift the glass up. But just tell me this. When you talk about, obviously, low sulfur is very important.
In a way, I mean, the goal is never to do a high sulfur.
Sulfur here?
Because we were going to drink it at home. We never planned to sell any of it. We only made about 500
so
bottles.
So that was the. Is yeah. there anything in the winemaking where you say this needs a little sulfur or a little
sure,
more?
Sure, certainly. If you need to stabilize the wine, I would yep. rather.
That's what'll determine.
It's the last thing we want to do because we want the yeast to work
right.
on their own. So it's the last possible thing. But if we need to add sulfur during vinification to save a wine from turning into like a VA monster,
right?
Then
so
we're,
every vintage, every particular,
yeah,
you
the,
know,
the
wine.
Too, but if we need yeah. to, then without question,
I mean, you go in with a philosophy and then. Yeah. You determine. All right, so I'm pouring the 2017 Côte de Bessée, yeah. the Domaine
This one is the Cuvée Red Wax, so it's Vieille-Vigne, old vines, and sans souffle, no sulfur.
Okay.
Yeah. And we don't write anything on the label. We just change the wax, and we won't make it every year. It's just if there is a wine that tastes particularly different, like a vat that's tasting something about it is tasting special, then we'll bottle off a little bit and wax and put red wax on it rather than the traditional gray that we use.
That's why it's the red wax.
Cuvée red wax,
To separate. Uh-huh. I tell everyone this all the time. We will post your wine list answers and the wine we drank on all our social media. You know, our listeners that follow us can get, you know, specific stuff. All right, Michelle, let's taste the wine, all right? So we hold it up and we look at, how would you describe the color?
It's a ruby red.
Ruby red, a little translucency.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty,
this one, we don't do any pigeage or any pump
pretty
over,
clear.
So it keeps that light color.
It's pretty clear, but, you know.
It's unfined, unfiltered, so there's a little cloudiness to it, which I...
Yeah, but not a cloudy, you know, crazy wine. All right, get your schnozola in the glass and tell me, give me your nose descriptors.
Well, again, it goes back to that the initial flavor the initial aromatic that I'm picking up is that dusty earth. Which for me is a beautiful attribute where it has that, you know, there's a minerality to the wine in that way. So it gives it not just the flavors of bright fruit, which you do want. It's Gamay.
Definitely
so
red fruit, some cherry, strawberry,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
There is that dust on it.
Which is really particular to the old vines. And we put some of this Cuvée in the regular Juliana in 2017, so those characters still remain in the regular Cuvée, but they're not as amplified.
Okay. Let's throw it
drink.
Over the tongue. No, we throw it over the tongue. We don't drink it.
Okay, do we say
but
sante?
Tell me about mouthfeel. Tell me.
Uh-huh.
I get acidity.
Definitely acidity is...
Nice.
Acidity is there for the lift. It gives it, body energy.
Very energetic.
Mm-hmm.
A medium.
A light to medium texture, yeah.
Medium.
17 was still a rich vintage, so...
Medium negative. Light to medium, right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not...
Yeah.
But it's very fresh in the mouth. It's a nice mouthfeel, nice attack of acidity. All right, let's taste it.
And again, going back to the texture of white wine. So you have the smooth tannins. You're not looking for thick tannins.
All right, let's taste it again and talk to me about the palate. and tell me if any of the nose descriptors obviously carry over to the palate. What do you get on the palate?
Same as stony minerality, but a stone, red fruit, you can say cherry, like bright cherry.
Yes, like not too bright.
Cherries. No, because really, you know, it's characteristic of the region also, or the village also, where you get wines that have darker fruit, but depending on where it's planted. If it's on the flatter ground, you start to get darker fruit aspects to it. But where the vines are for Côte de Bessée, where the parcel is, it's higher elevation. So it tends to stay cool with nice drainage, and it keeps...
There's something I'm getting.
Keeps it fresh.
There's something I'm getting on the mid palate, on the top of my mouth. It's not the fruit. I guess it's the stoniness or the minerality.
Mm.
It not that it separates, but it's there. I mean, I get the fruit, but I also, there's something very distinct.
Yeah, I just always, going back to this wine, it's just a dustiness, almost like a...
I think that's what it is.
Like cigar box, you can sometimes
I think that's,
say...
I was thinking
spices,
tobacco, but not
tea notes.
Hardcore tobacco.
Yeah.
You know, the elements of that.
Black tea.
Yeah, that's what it is. All those interesting notes.
Yeah, something other than fruit.
All right, so tell me, ideally, what a good food pairing with this is.
I think Beaujolais goes with everything. I have maybe not sea urchin, but everything else.
That's a great answer. I mean, that shows you how versatile. But,
yeah, absolutely.
But if you had to pick a couple of things that are a nice pairing.
You do traditional what's in the region also where you would have for... Beaujolais, really, it's a culture of pork. So
okay.
Everywhere you go, there's saucisson. It's always like accompaniment of lots of cheese and different types of meat and
go well with all of that, right?
Charcuterie. It was really, if you step into anybody's home, this is what they're going to serve you, and it's what you get locally in the region, and especially in Lyon, there are these local restaurants that are called Bouchon. And it's a place where you go and you eat and you drink, and traditionally you eat there. And it's funny, the lightest, like, it's not a fish region whatsoever, which is why I eat much more vegetarian now and less fish, but the most traditional dish there is called the quenelle, and it's made from, it could be a range of fish, but it's basically like a fish, like a puffy fish bread with a heavy crustacean cream sauce.
Really?
So that's like the fish course. So
what's it called?
If anyone, a quenelle. Q-U-E-N-E.
Oh, yeah.
L-L-E.
Quenelle, yes.
Yeah.
It's almost...
So if you're trying to eat light in Beaujolais, it's not going to happen.
No, it's almost like a dumpling, right? A quenelle?
It's... I don't know. It's like a squishy fish bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I love it. I love it.
Hard to find them in New York.
It's been a little while. I think the restaurant...
La Grande Vie.
I'm not sure if they have them. Okay.
They do. They're one of the last places.
I went there one
places.
Time. That was a trip. That was
yeah. That's a cool.
That was a
place.
Trip to the Upper East Side, not France. That was.
So you're happy with the way this wine came out, right?
Yes. Yeah. Of course. Over time, you always tweak it here and there, but yeah. it. Yeah,
and seven, we talked about 15 as a vintage and 16.
16 was our first year, though, and it was also a ripe vintage.
No, I know, but just the vintages in the area.
15, but we know
but
there's one
17
coming.
As a vintage was a good vintage to work
with. Yeah, it was quite cold, too, during harvest. So the conditions were nice where we don't chill the grapes, but it was naturally cold outside. And where our winery, our home is, it's up in the mountains, so it stays cooler than the other zones. So for that, it was like a natural temperature control.
All right, one last question, and then we have to wrap up the show.
Oh, no, I was having so much fun.
I told you it was going to go quickly. You have your property. You acquired some hectares.
Yeah.
Are you going to vinify those wines in a facility that you're going to build or have already?
We have our winery.
It's there now.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
I wasn't sure.
With Lapierre, they were really just helping us out to get started. And
okay.
Then in 17 we bought our home, and that's where the winery
okay.
is.
Okay, so 17 was the first vintage
in
your winery,
and
the 18th coming will be...
Also, we're in our
very
wine.
Nice.
So those ones are, they're fermenting. Some of them, this year are long ferments, and some of those wines are still ticking away the ferment. So, but while it's a little
sure.
warmer in Beaujolais now, it's
I'm
going.
Sure. All right, Michelle, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Let me wrap up here.
Sam.
If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation. You could follow us on Facebook @thegrapenation. follow us on Instagram at the hashtag The Grape Nation and at S Ben Ruby, BenRubi. On Twitter, we're at Ben Ruby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. You can subscribe to Grape Nation Podcast now on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. As I mentioned earlier, we'll post Michelle's wine list answers. We will give you specific information on the weekly wine sip, exactly what we drank. And any other wines that we mentioned, we'll talk about. Michelle, if we want to find you and David on social media and Domain Chappelle, where do we look and go?
We have an Instagram. It's under Domain Chappelle.
Okay. DomainChappelle.
Yes.
Domain
Chappelle. Yes.
And you don't post, do you? Do Instagram on your own?
Yes, I have one too. It's under my name, so Michelle.A.Smith.
Okay.
And then I post some.
Okay. Does
some Beaujolais photos.
You know what? I looked up David. He doesn't do a lot of.
Instagram. He doesn't use it. He uses the Chappelle a bit, but no, not too much.
And if people want to find out more about the domain, do you have a website?
We do. It's not very extensive at this point.
Okay.
But anybody can write me a message on Instagram, and I'm happy to talk.
All right. I want to thank our guest, Michelle Smith Chappelle from Domain Chappelle. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for the insight into Beaujolais.
I feel so good to be back in New York.
Sort of an insight into starting up, you know, a winery in a very established region. So thank you, and thank you for bringing the wine in. Thanks to our engineers and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.